Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith, and welcome to August. Neil Stavem here, Ted Ross there, Chris is at the phones. Ted, seems like summer kind of scooting by a little bit, doesn't it now?
When you get to this point in the year, it just is like, oh, I didn't do this, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I've got to get these trips in or tend to my garden better or whatever it is.
And you're it's sort of full speed ahead and thinking back to school stuff probably for the kids, right? You're just doing some shopping and all that.
Yeah,
so.
Only a couple weeks for my younger one. She's thrilled about
that.
I bet
not. Not at all. No, that's no good. So, hey, there is something going on in the Twin Cities coming up this month, and our ministry spotlight, we've been talking about a Convoy of Hope, and we've been telling the opportunity there to have an impact in the community. This month's ministry spotlight is Open Doors. Open Doors has been working to empower and equip Christians who are persecuted through training, relief, and support, and we've got information on that on our website. It's kind of a new feature of Faith Radio with the ministry spotlight every month.
Excellent.
We'll check that out. Also, when you're there, when you go to myfaithradio.com, you'll note an opportunity to get a free download of Alistair Begg's latest book called Lasting Love. And you can request a free download of the audio book. It's about helping build and maintain a solid foundation in your marriage. So I want to encourage you to check that out. That's available as a wonderful resource this month. We have a resource that I'm looking forward to diving in, talking about from a guest that we've talked to in the past who has been busy and just continues to write really significant discussions when it comes to how we can make sure that we're doing the right kind of work in helping those that are needy and impoverished, but doing it in the right way. Brian Fickert, Dr. Brian Fickert, is the founder and executive director of the Chalmers Center for Economic Development at Covenant College, where he serves as a professor of economics and community development. He earned a Ph.D. with distinction in economics from Yale University, specializing in third world economic development and international economics. And you really do, you need, it is, I think Rich Stearns from World Vision said, you know, solving the problems of the poor really is rocket science.
That's right.
But you noticed over the last, few years, maybe a dozen years now, microfinance has been kind of the, maybe the buzzword. People talking about that, you know, and we're going to find out more about that. Because the world is changing, and while we enjoy prosperity in the West, much of the world still lives on, over 2.5 billion people in the majority world live on less than $2 a day. Great disparity. Dr. Fickert, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
It's great to be with you folks again today. Thanks for having me on.
Well, talk a little bit about, as you address right at the outset of the book, by the way, the book's called From Dependence to Dignity, How to Alleviate Poverty Through Church-Centered Microfinance. And it's written with your partner there, Russell Mask. And Brian, you address the reality that the world is shifting in terms of the center of Christianity to the global south. So talk about the implications of that shift.
It's really just an incredible situation in which the church is growing very, very rapidly in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and, of course, is struggling in Western Europe and to some degree in North America. And so there's a little bit of a passing of the baton taking place that's been documented by a number of missiologists that the center of Christianity has really moved. And what's kind of interesting to consider is that in many ways, the church that's on the front line of the advancement of the kingdom of God are some of the poorest churches on the planet. We churches that have people living on less than $2 a day are actually on the front lines of the advancement of the kingdom of God. And then coexisting with those churches are churches in North America and Western Europe, churches that are very wealthy. And so it's really a unique moment in history because there's greater disparities in income and wealth within the body of Christ than there's ever been. And so it raises some really interesting questions about how do we, as a relatively well-to-do church, get behind our brothers and sisters who are on the front lines of the advancement of the kingdom in ways that really empower them, in ways that don't step on their toes, in ways that in which we don't take over, but in ways that allow them, the local manifestation of Jesus Christ in very poor communities, in ways that allows them to use their gifts, their abilities, and their resources to minister the good news, the kingdom of God in words and in deeds amongst the poor, many of whom are themselves. And so the book is kind of trying to speak into that space.
Just thinking, and it's not necessarily something you particularly address in the book, but it seems like our Western system has been, well, we accumulate power and influence, and that's the way we can facilitate change. But obviously, if you're $2 a day, you're the extreme poor, you're not going to be able to come against maybe corrupt systems, are you?
Yeah, it's so interesting. Of course, we believe that Christ is Lord of all. He's Lord of international systems and national systems and local systems. He's Lord of everything, and we should have a sense of hope and optimism that his kingdom will bring about justice at all levels of the cosmos. But you're correct. The reality of it is that oftentimes the kingdom advances amongst the poor. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 says that God has chosen the foolish things and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are. And so oftentimes we see the kingdom advancing in places where the world would least expect it. And so as the church in very poor communities around the world is advancing, it's often from the bottom up. It's often from those marginalized in all systems. But sometimes they can address systems at a very micro level just enough to allow some breathing room for the poor. And so part of what we think microfinance can do is empower very poor churches to change the financial system just enough to enable the poor to have a little bit more hope in being able to move forward. Even though they can't change the macro system, the national system, they can do just enough change on a micro level to make some difference in the lives of the poor.
We'll be talking about that during the hour. We do have a copy of Brian's new book to give away. If you'd love to want to read this important study, and it would be a great resource. There's also information online if you go to chalmers.org for the Chalmers Center for Economic Development. It's Covenant College, but it's just chalmers.org and then /dignity. You'll find a great deal of information just about the book and other resources as well from Brian Fickert, who's written the best-selling book, When Helping Hurts, How to Alleviate Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Yourself. So we do have a copy to give away at the end of the hour. It's 877-93-FAITH. If you'd like to sign up for that, for the drawing, 877-93-FAITH. Brian, because, we live in the prosperous West, and, the world is 2.5 billion living on $2 a day. Is it just a matter of redistribution? That was kind of one of the theories, I guess, all the way along, wasn't it, in terms of development? It's just a matter of, and I suppose it goes back to Apostle Paul, too, right, that we, those that have, should share with those that don't have.
Well, I do think that the Bible does talk about some sense of redistribution. The Apostle Paul, as you already mentioned, was certainly involved in that, taking up a collection from some of the churches to bring to the church at Jerusalem who was struggling under a famine. And so there was a sense of redistribution there. There is a sense in Scripture, 1 John chapter 3, if any of us has material possession and sees our brother or sister in need but has no compassion on them, how can the love of God be in us? And so there is a sense that those of us who've been entrusted with untold wealth, really unprecedented wealth in human history, we've got to share that wealth with our brothers and sisters around the world, but that's easier said than done. How we share that wealth really matters. And so often, as we described when helping hurts, so often the way that we go about using our wealth, the way that we go about trying to help the poor actually can create dependency. It can actually cripple the poor. And so we've got to share, we've got to redistribute, but how we do it really matters. And so one of the things the Chalmers Center has been involved in since our inception, I guess about a little over 16 years ago, was how can we help local church in the majority world of Africa, Asia, and Latin America to use microfinance, which can be a very empowering sort of initiative, a very empowering sort of intervention. How can the local church use microfinance to empower the poor in a way that doesn't create dependency on the part of the poor? And so this book is about that. How can we help the local church without creating dependency on the part of that local church? Part of the course to two dependencies on the local church on us, and it's the elder poor on the local church in Africa, Asia, and Latin America.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. Your phone's breaking up a little bit, Brian, so maybe we'll just do a reconnect here, see if we get a little cleaner line, and then we're going to come back, and we will address that question. How does the church in the West serve the global poor in a significant way, one that doesn't hurt the poor? And we're going to learn more about from dependence to dignity, how to alleviate poverty through Christ-centered microfinance. A good teaching and training session today. Glad to have you listening into Connecting Faith. Again, we've got a copy of the book to give away. We'll do the drawing at the end of the hour. It's 877-93-FAITH. If you'd like to sign up for a copy of the book. And if you have a question, maybe you've been involved in some projects, some microfinance, maybe you've been supporting some of your church has, you've done some mission trips, some service projects, and like to join the conversation, you're welcome. It's 877-933-2484, and we'll continue in just a moment. The question we're talking about today is, how can churches and missionaries in the majority world effectively address the devastating poverty, both inside their congregations and just outside their doors? How can churches in the economically advantaged countries effectively partner with the Global South churches in the process? That's the topic being addressed today as we review the book, From Dependence to Dignity, How to Alleviate Poverty Through Christ-Centered Microfinance. Dr. Brian Fickert is our guest today, founder and executive director of the Chalmers Center for Economic Development at Covenant College. He serves as a professor of economics and community development there as well, and he's written the landmark book, When Helping Hurts, How to Alleviate Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Yourself. Dr. Fickert, maybe just say a word about, you mentioned the microfinance. That's been a word that we've kind of heard about over the last, decade or so. What does it really mean?
Yeah, most poor people in the majority world do not have access to jobs. There simply are not enough jobs to provide employment. And so most folks have to be self-employed. They've got to run their own very small microenterprises. And so a number of years ago, Muhammad Yunus, who's an economist who eventually won the Nobel Prize, actually, for this, started to make very, very small loans to very poor people, so they could start or expand their own microenterprises. And that became really a global industry. But microfinance has actually expanded beyond that. It's expanded beyond just loans for businesses, because poor people need access to financial services for a whole range of things. They need, they need lump sums of money. They either need to be able to save or borrow money, invest in small businesses, yes, but also for household investments, things like, fixing a hole in the roof, or for life cycle expenditure, things like weddings and funerals, or for emergencies. Perhaps a child is sick and needs to see a doctor. They need a large sum of money to pay the doctor bill. Or finally, for consumption spending. It's said that the poor live on $2 a day, but actually, it's more like they live on $3 today and tomorrow on 5 cents. Their incomes fluctuate heavily, so they need a way to smooth out their consumption because their incomes fluctuate so much. And so the poor need access to financial services, the ability to save and to borrow for all of those range of needs that I just mentioned. And unfortunately, there aren't really good banking or financial services available to them. They often, if they want to borrow money, they often have to borrow money from loan sharks that charge them anywhere between 300 and 1,200% interest per year. And even if they want to save, there's no banks for them to save in. And so they actually will sometimes put their money on deposit with like a savings shark. In Nigeria, there's a savings shark, a lady who takes people's deposits from them, and she'll charge them 80% for the privilege of their saving money with her. And so clearly the poor are willing to pay for financial services. They pay a lot for them, but they need greater access to them at more affordable rates. And so microfinance tries to provide those financial services to enable the poor to save and to borrow for all those ranges of needs.
Well, you address in the book, too, the sort of the web of the challenge, the downward spiral that affects so many poor. I mean, because you said, maybe one day it's $3 a day, the next day it's 5 cents, but there's also health issues. And, I mean, it almost seems like an endless cycle where you can't get out.
It's terrible. It's often called the web of deprivation. It's like they're caught in a spider's web. With so many things that are entangling them, and if you've ever watched a spider's web, when a bug flies in there, the more the bug tries to move and to wiggle to get out of the web, the more it gets entangled in the web, and so after a while the bug just kind of stops moving. And I think that's a good analogy for the lives of the poor. They're so entangled, they're so ensnared, and every time they try to make a move, every time they try to wiggle out, they can often just get more ensnared. And so microfinance is trying to help with that a little bit. Let me just give you a quick example. If I'm a very poor person and I need to borrow money for starting a microenterprise, if I'm having to pay 1,200% interest on that loan, well, if I've got a bad day of revenue, there's not much profits, and then the money lender comes to me and says, I need you to pay me back, and I don't have the money there that day, that's going to grind me further into poverty, because that money lender is going to take advantage of me. He might see some of my assets. He might even see the child. And so it can grind the family deeper and deeper into poverty. And so microfinance is trying to sort of start to untangle that, to say there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a way for the poor to acquire capital without having to be plunged into debt by unscrupulous money lenders. And so it's trying to undo that web of entanglement.
Are we assuming that this is all about entrepreneurship? Or, I mean, as you said, it's expanded beyond that, right? So it's not just somebody wants to grow their business necessarily.
No, the industry really started out focusing on expanding microenterprises, but the industry has discovered more recently, again, that the poor need access to financial services for a whole range of things. Let me give you an example. The Chalmers Center is doing some work in Togo in West Africa, and we asked the women who are part of our microfinance work there, what difference does this microfinance group make in your life? And one of the answers they give is that their husbands beat them less because of the microfinance group. That's not an obvious answer to hear. And as we probe deeper and say, what do you mean your husbands beat you less? And they said in our culture, it's the woman's responsibility to put food on the table. And some days we just have enough income, and so we don't have enough money to buy food to put food on the table. And so our husbands will beat us. But because of the Savings and Credit Association that we're part of, we're able on those lean days to go to the group to borrow some money or withdraw some of our savings to buy food, to put food on the table so our husbands don't beat us. And that's not an obvious kind of answer, but it gets at the heart of this. The poor need finance for a whole range of things in their lives, many things beyond microenterprise. And this approach to microfinance can really empower the poor in those multiple settings. Another example would be keeping your kids in school. The poor have to pay school fees. And so the poor will often use microfinance to fund the school fees to keep their children in school, which will result, we hope, in increased incomes in the next generation. And so it's way beyond entrepreneurship into really all aspects of life.
Do we tend to be maybe biased in assuming that the extremely poor don't really understand finances, and we'd have to come in with the training in terms of the basics of economics?
Well, that's a great question. One of the principles that we talk about in When Helping Hurts is the idea of asset-based development, of trying to discover the assets, the gifts that are already there, and then building on those gifts and assets. And so we've tried to bring that to bear on our work in microfinance in a number of ways. The first is the poor actually can and do save. And that's kind of a shock to many people. Historically, microfinance has involved donors from the West giving money, that money being lent to the poor and then collecting the money back from the poor. And there's still a need for that. But it's also the case that the poor can actually save their own money. They don't always have to be borrowing from the West. If you provide them with a system to save their own money. They can do that, and they do it. They do it all the time. And so we've been able to help the poorest, some of the very poorest people on the planet, to save money, to accumulate money, their own money. Second dimension of the asset-based idea is to build on local knowledge. Much of what is happening in our work is we are helping churches to promote savings and credit associations. They're owned and operated by the poor themselves. There's no outside loan capital, but the group itself is being run by the poor. Now, how can they do that? Well, partly because the poor themselves have developed savings and credit associations. They already have a lot of the intuition for this. We're just kind of coming along and building on local knowledge and helping them to improve upon what they already know. And so it's always an approach of local resources, local knowledge, build on the image-bearing gifts that God has already placed there.
You talked about loan capital and no outside loan capital. That's one of the issues, isn't it, that even though we're making money available through loans, people don't always want to take out loans.
It's often the case that the poor would rather save than borrow. You know, the Bible, of course, warns us against becoming overly indebted, that the borrower is often beholden to the lender. And, you know, that's true for all of us, but it's particularly true for the poor. One of the qualities of being poor is that you're highly vulnerable. You kind of live life on the edge of a cliff. And so one mistake, one misjudgment, planting the wrong crop one year, making a bad business decision, one small mistake can essentially plunge you over a cliff. A child might die. And so the poor are highly averse to risk. They don't like risk. They avoid risk like the plague. And quite frankly, borrowing money is riskier than saving money. And so the poorest people around the world would typically rather save than borrow. And by using a particular approach to microfinance that we're using, we're essentially helping them to mobilize their own savings to help them start what's kind of like a small, very primitive credit union in which the poor save and lend their own money to one another.
Some fascinating opportunities in the world of relief and development, and much of it as a result of the good study of Dr. Brian Fickert, who's the founder and executive director of the Chalmers Center for Economic Development at Covenant College. He also serves as a professor of economics and community development there. He has a Ph.D. in economics from Yale University, specializing in third world economic development and international economics. He's written a landmark book called When Helping Hurts, How to Alleviate Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Yourself. And the new book we're referencing today is From Dependence to Dignity, How to Alleviate Poverty Through Church-Centered Microfinance. We're going to focus on that church-centered part of that here coming up in just a moment. We've got a copy of the book to give away, and if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Or you can send us a note online, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page for the email link there. And we'll talk more with Brian Fickert in a moment.
Radio.
I want to be your hands. I want to be your feet. I'll go where you send me. Go where you send me. Be your hands. I want to be your feet. I'll go where you send me.
Well, that's our heart, isn't it? We want to be the hands and feet of Jesus and to share with those. And the church is in a unique moment in history. The average Christian living in the economically advanced country enjoys great levels of prosperity. And at the same time, over 2.5 billion people in the majority world, Africa, Asia, Latin America, live on less than $2 a day. And so the questions we're asking is, all right, how do we in the majority world effectively address poverty in these congregations? And how are those churches in the global south, you know, carrying out the Great Commission effectively? Dr. Brian Fickert is helping us on that topic today. He and his co-leader at the Chalmers Center for Economic Development, Covenant College, Dr. Russell Mask, have written a new book called From Dependence to Dignity, How to Alleviate Poverty Through Church-Centered Microfinance. Let me just mention that if you go to chalmers.org/dignity, you'll find a lot more information about this book and, of course, some of the writings of Dr. Fickert as well. Brian, tell me a little bit about the importance of church-centered microfinance, because we want to I mean, you know, we want to be involved. We want to do something. This seems like a good idea. You know, it doesn't take a lot of money from us, but it can go a long way, right?
Yeah, you know, Neil, I think you really hit on something earlier when you're talking about how the poor are often entangled in a web of poverty. And so no single intervention is going to be able to entangle them completely from that web. But part of what's in that web, part of what locks the poor into poverty actually has to do with oftentimes worldview issues, oftentimes people's understanding of themselves, of God, of others, and of the rest of the world have been distorted by Satan. Satan has woven lies into every culture. And because people often don't understand who God is, who they are as bearers of his image, because they don't understand they've been called to be stewards of creation to effect change in the world around them, and because at our core, our hearts are idol factories. We worship idols. We make idols. We don't worship the one true God. For all of these reasons, at the end of the day, what the poor need and what you and I need is the gospel. We need the power of Jesus Christ to come in to reshape our worldview, to reshape our minds, to reshape our hearts, and to restore us to as his image bearers. And Christ does that through the local church. And so the Chalmers Center has always believed if you really want to help the poor, what the poor need is a profound and deep encounter with Jesus Christ, just as you and I do. And that profound encounter happens in the context of the local church. And so in all of our work, what we're trying to do is to help the local church to minister to the poor in a way that draws the poor into the life of the church, where they encounter Jesus Christ himself, who is the ultimate solution to all of our poverty. And so that's why all our work is so centered on the church. That's why our work tries to figure out how to equip the local church, often consisting of very poor people, to be able to communicate the gospel, because ultimately that's where the change comes from.
So does the local church need resources from the West, or you know, can they, is it better if they actually don't have material support from us?
That's a great question. It comes down to how those resources are introduced. I don't think there's a question that we have to be sharing our resources with our brothers and sisters around the world, but we've got to be doing so in a way that avoids, again, dependency on the part of the local church and dependency on the part of the poor. And that's easier said than done. You know, the truth of the matter is, because of the history of colonialism, because of the history of relations between rich and poor countries and rich Christians and poor Christians, because of all of that history and all of those dynamics, the reality of it is, if I were to walk into a village in Africa, Asia, or Latin America and suggest that we do something, the people there are very likely to say yes, partly out of politeness, partly out of a history of dynamics that they don't really have voice, partly out of a history that if they say what we want them to say, we'll give them more money. And so it's actually very difficult to introduce outside resources that the poor really want. It's very difficult to introduce interventions that the local church and the poor really own, because they'll kind of say yes to whatever we suggest they say yes to, because they view us as donors. And so, yes, we must share resources, but we've got to do so in a way that's empowering. And part of what's empowering is when we actually follow the lead of the local church, when we follow their vision for ministry, when we follow their priorities. It's very hard for us to do that as Westerners. So part of what our book talks about is how can we distribute things like training and equipping of local churches to use microfinance ministries? How can we actually distribute this in a way that's really, truly empowering? And one of the things we do in our work is we actually make the local church pay something to be trained, heavily subsidized. So there's a sense in which this is a way that Western Christians and Western churches are sharing the resources, but the sharing is coming in the form of subsidizing training. But the very poor churches themselves actually pay something to be trained, and then they're the ones that move the ministry forward using their own resources and their own gifts. And we think it's profoundly important that we distribute this way, because we want to know what they really want. And one way to determine that is by what they're willing to pay for.
Give some examples, or maybe, you know, one or two examples of what a microfinance system looks like in a local church. You mentioned about, you know, there's a group. It's almost like a credit union. Just kind of walk us through a little bit about what does that look like?
Yeah, there's various forms of microfinance. We use what's called a savings-led approach to microfinance, in which the poorest churches in the world will promote in the congregation and in the community what's called a savings and credit association. And basically, it's just a weekly meeting in which the poor people come together and they elect their own leaders. They elect a chair, usually, and a vice chair, and a secretary, and a treasurer. And they determine how much money they're going to save every week, how much money they're going to have available for lending, what the interest rate on loans will be. They determine all of the rules. It's like setting up their own very small credit union. They determine all the rules and come together every week, and they execute what they've decided. They might save 25 cents a week each person. That money goes into a pot, and the group will vote who in the group can get a loan out of that pot and at what interest rate. And so they just run their own very small, very primitive credit union. But the curriculum that we use to help churches to start those groups is deeply rooted in the gospel. It's deeply rooted in the good news of who Jesus Christ is. It's deeply committed to worldview transformation, so that every lesson is centered on how Christ can help us to overcome the obstacles to making these groups work, obstacles like our own sin, that we sometimes cheat, we sometimes steal, we sometimes break our word. And so the context of the group meeting provides an opportunity for evangelism and discipleship in the power of Jesus Christ to overcome our own sin. We also equip churches to add into those weekly meetings lessons on small business, lessons on household financial management, lessons on health, all from a biblical worldview perspective, because, again, poverty isn't just about a lack of stuff. It's about a mindset and a heart set that need to be transformed. And so the group meeting becomes a context for evangelism and discipleship and prayer, mutual support, encouragement, worship, singing. It's like a small worship service, really.
And there's a great deal of accountability in this group, isn't it? I mean,
it's their money.
Yeah, and in each other. I mean, they form groups right by association. I mean, they know who is trustworthy already, right?
Exactly. So again, that idea of an asset-based approach. When I walk into a poor community, I don't know who can be trusted and who can't be trusted. But the poor themselves do know this. The members of the community do know the reputation of one another. And so, again, you're trying to tap into their local knowledge. And so they're only going to invite people into their group who have some history of being faithful with money. Sometimes they kind of learn as they go. You know, you build trust over time. So, Neil, you know, if you asked me for a loan right there over the phone, I might go, well, I don't know Neil that well. He's up there in Twin Cities. He's probably a Minnesota Vikings fan. They can't be trusted because I'm a Packers fan. And so I might only lend you $10. But then if you pay it back, I might go, you know, maybe we can go up to 15. And so kind of over time, I would learn to trust you. I would have some basic level of trust, but my trust in you would grow as I observe your behavior. And that's the same for these groups. There's some basic level of trust, but as they proceed through time, the trust can build. And as the trust builds, the amount of money that's being transacted can build over time. They do have a very high incentive to hold one another accountable because it's their money. You know, the number of examples we've observed of, you know, a church from the United States giving, let's say, $5,000 to a church in Uganda to lend and collect back, that often doesn't work because the local people know that the money is from the West and it's nobody's money, it's other people's money, right? And so the money often doesn't get repaid. But when it's your own money, when the group members are lending their own money to one another, they have a pretty strong incentive to screen candidates for loans well and to hold those people accountable for repaying their loans well. And so it's really a very decentralized kind of banking in which the very, very grassroots folks are holding each other accountable for keeping their promises.
And this is working at, I mean, there we know statistically, right, that extreme poverty has been decreasing over the last few years. But is this actually one of the keys that's making it work?
Yeah, you know, there's quite a bit of debate right now about what is the role of microfinance in poverty alleviation. And some really thought it would be kind of the silver bullet that would launch people out of poverty. And some recent studies have suggested that that's just not the case, that it turns out that many poor people are not the world's leading entrepreneurs. And if you give them a $30 loan, they don't become Bill Gates and Microsoft overnight. Shocker. And so there's a little bit of a sense of this is not the easy upward escalator out of poverty. But what the research is finding is that particularly if one uses the savings blood approach that I've been describing, which builds not on loans but on savings, there is evidence that it does stabilize life. It's not so much that your income goes up dramatically. It's more like you are getting tossed about and batted around by life, and life becomes more stable. There's more of a cushion. There's less wild swings. And because of that, you're less vulnerable. Children don't get sick as often. Children can stay in school longer. The family life is more stable. It gives the family some breathing room to think about its future in a way that it couldn't before. And so it's not a silver bullet out of poverty, but it does seem to be very powerful as a stabilizer, as a reducer of vulnerability. And then we're seeing, in addition to that, very strong social and spiritual impacts. Group members will often say things like, I was all alone before, and now I'm not alone anymore. I have a family. People say things like, I used to feel very bad about myself, and now I have dignity. I understand that I am somebody, and I have hope and a future. And then people say things like, I didn't know who Jesus Christ was, and now I know who Jesus Christ is, and he's my Savior. And so we're seeing very dramatic social and spiritual impacts in addition to the stabilized economic ones.
Good insight today from Dr. Brian Fickert. Brian is the founder and executive director of the Chalmers Center for Economic Development at Covenant College. He also serves as professor of economics and community development there. You can find out more at chalmers.org. And you want to find out about the new book, From Dependence to Dignity, How to Alleviate Poverty Through Church-Centered Microfinance. Go to chalmers.org/dignity. You'll find the material there as well. And we'll continue more with Dr. Brian Fickert. He's co-written this new book, From Dependence to Dignity, with Dr. Russell Mask at the Chalmers Center. And we want to talk a little bit about, you know, how we should measure results and what, you know, what are we actually looking for? What's going to be the key that will tell us? And how do we get the solutions to the people who most need it? That is one of the questions that we'll address as well. We'll get to that in just a minute. Stay tuned. Past the hour, talking today with Brian Fickert. Brian's founder and president of the Chalmers Center for Economic Development at Covenant College. He also serves there as a professor of economics and community development. He's co-authored the best-selling book, When Helping Hurts, How to Alleviate Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Yourself. And he's co-authored a brand new one, which is a follow-up. It's From Dependence to Dignity, How to Alleviate Poverty Through Church-Centered Microfinance with Dr. Brian Fickert and Dr. Russell Mask. And it's published by Zondervan. You can find out more online at chalmers.org/dignity. We do have a copy of the book we'll give away here at the end of the hour. You can be a part of that drawing at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Brian, we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, the importance of accountability and trust in these small groups of microfinance. I'm interested in your perspective why relief and development agencies and staff haven't been more willing to work with local churches. I mean, they seem to have some distrust of the church.
Yeah, that's a really painful question, you know, and there's so many factors that go into that. I will say that first at a very general level that oftentimes Christian relief and development work is done apart from the local church. In fact, oftentimes if you ask Christian relief and development workers, what they think of the local church, they'll often speak about it with considerable disdain, or at least oftentimes a level of disinterest. And quite frankly, the funding sources that are typically used by Christian relief and development agencies exacerbate the problem, because often government funding is being used, which preclude a lot of evangelism and discipleship and working with the local church in a more gospel-centered way. And so it's a very painful thing to admit, but it's really true. I think there's a lot of things that go behind that. I think part of it has to do with really a Western materialistic understanding of what human flourishing is. You know, so often we reduce human flourishing to having more stuff, having more to consume, having more material goods. But the Bible teaches that human flourishing is actually about image bearing, that we are created in the image of God, that the fall has distorted that image bearing, but that in Christ we are being renewed as image bearers. And to be an image bearer is more than having more to eat. One way of understanding image bearing, again, is to say that human beings are wired for relationship with God, with ourselves, with others, and the rest of creation. So human flourishing then becomes living rightly with respect to God, self, others, and the rest of creation. And that's far more than just having more to eat. It's far more than having more stuff. It has to do with proper relationship. And I think that in many respects, the Christian relief and development ministry has bought into a Western paradigm too often that focuses on the material. And if we could move in a more relational understanding of human beings and of human flourishing and of the role of Christ in restoring us as image bearers, I think the importance of the local church would be on the rise. And so I think there's actually a theological problem on our part in the West that's been the driver of a lot of the work that's gone around the local church and undermined the local church rather than seeing the local church as central.
Why is it so difficult to get the quote-unquote solutions to the people who need it most? I mean, we, you know, there are cell phones around the globe. Coca-Cola has managed to, you know, get around the globe.
Yeah.
Why is this so challenging in terms of distribution?
Yeah, it's the problem of the nonprofits. You know, a business has a nice setup, because when the business serves the customer well, the customer pays for the product or service that's being delivered, right? So if I am McDonald's and I serve good Big Macs, I get a reward immediately from doing that. The customer pays me for those Big Macs, and I can then use that money to cover my costs and to produce more Big Macs. And so it's a very nice alignment of incentives to serve the customer. And if I don't serve the customer well, the customer will punish me by taking their dollars across the street to a different restaurant, right? So the customer is in charge. The customer can demand what they want, and the business has incentive to serve them well. When we get to the world of poverty, we have a problem, because the customer, that is the poor person, typically can't pay the full cost. Sometimes they can't pay any of the cost of the good or service that's being provided to them. And so the provider, in this case, the nonprofit organization, faces a dilemma, because as they serve the poor, they don't get any reward financially for doing so. There's no automatic feedback mechanism. And so the nonprofit is necessarily going to have to serve the financial supporter of the ministry as well. And that's where the problem comes in. Because I doubt that very many of the listeners on our program today got out of bed this morning and said, you know, what the poor people in the world really need are access to better savings and loan services. I doubt that any of your listeners today thought that what the poor really need is access to savings and loan services. We are so far removed from their world that we don't understand it very well. And so we to give money to things to us. We tend to want to give money to nonprofits that do what we think is a good idea. And so that gap between the one who's paying nonprofit and the one who's receiving the services of the nonprofit, the poor people, that gap creates a huge problem for distribution. It's a huge problem to actually get poor what they really want. Because what the poor get are what the donors want the poor to, and that alignment is a huge problem in the nonprofit sector.
So let's talk about results. How should we measure results, and maybe what kind of metrics are you looking for at the Chalmers Center to make sure that there's a lasting difference?
Well, that's a great question, Neil. You know, again, most of the metrics that are used in the poverty alleviation industry, again, have been very heavily shaped by the Western worldview, which says that human flourishing comes from consuming more stuff, and the constraint on consuming more stuff is income. And so the measures that the West tends to use and that economists certainly have promoted are things that measure increases in incomes. So, for example, if you turn on the evening news, you'll hear about the gross domestic product of the United States, and whether it's on up or down. It's a measure of output or income. I certainly think that's important. Human flourishing is much more than just more consumption coming from more income. Again, it has to do with the relationship. And so I wish I could tell you that we've got this all figured out. We don't. In fact, a lot of what I'm going to be doing the next year is looking at these measures more thoroughly. But what we're trying to do is to come up with measures for human flourishing in terms of image bearing. What kinds of measures could we look at to suggest people are living more in relationship to God, of others, the rest of creation? For us, that's the right metric. And so it's much harder to measure. There's not 75 years of the history of measuring these things. We're having to kind of make it up with other folks and test the things out for us. That's the goal. It's so interesting. I'm reading through the Psalms right now, my personal devotions. And interesting, as you start looking at what David is often saying, he often talks about how the ungodly have full bellies, and they seem to be thriving economically. And then he pulls back and says, but one thing I ask of you, this is what I seek, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord forever, in the gaze of the Lord, all the days of my life. It's not to say that material progress doesn't matter. It does. But it's interesting how David defines the primary goal as being with God. And so our measures have to change. Our measures have to be informed by Scripture, rather than by a secular Western understanding of human flourishing.
Just a minute and a half left or so. I'm just wondering if someone listening today, and the church has 1,000 or 2,000 members, they've got several thousand dollars they could invest. What would you recommend?
Yeah, we really believe that a really excellent role for Western resources is often in the space of training. And so we have to do that. I remember you said that money would be to pay for the training and equipping of majority world churches to use holistic ministries, including microfinance ministries. And there's a number of organizations out there that you could look at to fund, certainly the Chalmers Center, but International is one of our closest partners. And Hope International is doing marvelous work all over the world in this space using our training curriculum. That another organization for you to consider. Saddleback Church right now is using our training curriculum for rolling out some things in Africa and other parts of the world. That's another source or another organization or church for you to look at funding as well.
Good word today from Brian Fickert. Dr. Brian Fickert is founder and executive director of the Chalmers Center for Economic Development. They're at Covenant College. He serves as a professor of economics and community development there as well. You can find out more about the new book, From Dependence to Dignity, How to Alleviate Poverty Through Church-Centered Microfinance. Fascinating reading. You can go to chalmers.org and then /dignity, and that'll get you a great deal of information, not only about this book, but about Dr. Fickert's previous book, When Helping Hurts, How to Alleviate Poverty Without Hurting the Poor and Yourself. Some great insight, and done a great deal of study in this area. And we're so thankful to have an opportunity to chat with him, even though he's a Packers fan. Brian, good to talk with you again today.
So. Thanks so much for testing with you, Neil.
All right. Brian Fickert joining us today on Connecting Faith. You want to, if you missed part of the show, you can listen to it again. We post the interviews online after the program. Go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page for the podcast archives. It's myfaithradio.com.